Hello, everybody, and welcome to That Millennial Life. My name is Joe Cole. This is my podcast where I talk to millennials about their lives and how they are managing young adulthood. Sorry, I got a little bit of season-changing allergies right now. So today on the podcast, Tom Salerno. I talked to Tom Salerno, who you'll learn more about very soon. But before that, let's give Stav, my friend Mustafa Eligar, the most frequent guest on this podcast, let's give him a call. I want to ask him about a few things from last week's podcast. Let's give him a ring.
Yeah.
Yo, what's up?
Nothing much.
How are you?
I am on my rooftop deck. It is gorgeous out. A little chilly. And the sunset is looking incredible.
Yeah, I know, dude. So for people who don't know, I was in Baltimore a few weekends ago because Stav recently moved down there. If you listen to episode 40, the episode where he interviewed me, and I told a lot of people, and I think I told you that going down to Baltimore and hanging out with all of our friends for one last time kind of felt like the end of an era, right?
Yeah. And I mean, if you want to be dark about it.
Everyone's gone, and it's like a new chapter, but it wasn't all sadness.
It felt like one of the more planned times that we try to meet up, and I feel like the more you have to plan these kind of things, the more it tends to not be as natural of a hangout.
Yeah, but it was good. It was good stuff.
When everyone was here, it was the best.
Yeah. Sorry, I just got a text message. Anyway, so I'm calling you because I had an episode of my podcast. Last episode, I had Vanessa Tripona as a guest, and we talked about some things that afterwards I talked about with you because you listened to the podcast after. You listened to the episode, and you had some interesting points after, and I asked if you wouldn't mind coming on and continuing the conversation, continuing the dialogue, because... like I said in that last episode as well, I kind of criticized a lot of the ways in which, you know, people our age try to put their points out publicly, and that a lot of the times it isn't effective. And I think that, you know, this is an effective way, and that I hope that this is a dialogue that can continue. So, vagueness.
Right.
Last week, me and Vanessa talked about kind of the societal romantic and sexual bias against overweight women, and I talked to you, and you kind of gave me some reasons that you thought were legitimate in, you know, it not being superficial to from kind of an emotional perspective and a physical perspective, why it's not superficial to want to have a sexual partner who's a female who is in shape. Is that correct, kind of?
Yeah. So, I mean, I can only talk through my scope.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not trying to make generalizations, but
through your
I would assume that there are people who share the same viewpoints as me, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I could be wrong, but... And I also want to say it was a cool episode because it was... Definitely a topic that, like, no one talks about, but it's definitely, like, a thing.
Right, yeah, it's like a universal elephant in the room.
Yes, and Vanessa, thank you for the compliments. You're too kind. I was red in the face when
I
was listening to
that beautiful
podcast. Yeah, that made my week. I'm still high off of it. Anyway, I can tell you that I am attracted to a girl. I'll be honest, like, I mean, not like a bodybuilder, but like, if a girl has a little muscle on her, like, I kind of find it sexy. Like,
mm-hmm.
if a girl is in shape, mm-hmm. that is sexy to me. And what that means to me is, I mean, I like to take care of myself. I try eating right and exercising. I'm no, like, hardo about it, but it's definitely part of my daily regimen.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, it's an easy assumption with some legitimate evidence. If I see a girl who's in shape, to me, I can kind of fairly assume that she is someone who's diligent about her about that part of her life, about her exercise and her dieting. And it's not like and I'm sure there are some, you know, people who are overweight who are just as diligent, if not more than me, and can't be in shape or whatever, for whatever reason. But it's, you know, there's so many factors that play a role. Like, I would like to limit them. So it's a good assumption for me to assume that if a girl's in shape, that means that she's diligent. And to me, I admire that. Like, I admire someone who can take care of their body.
You, 'cause you take the time to, you know, care about your health and care about, you know, make sure that you're in shape, so that if you see that in someone else, that's kind of an emotional justification that you don't think is superficial. And I don't either.
Yes, I mean, I think it's a two-tier one. It's like saying, like, if I was obsessed with baseball and I met a girl, like, if I saw a girl walking down the street with a mitt in her hand, mm-hmm. I would be like, oh, wow, like, I find that girl attractive or something. Like, something that there's a common bond. Mm-hmm. That's how it is with this thing we're talking about. But on top of that, yeah, I could assume that she's somewhat diligent, and that is actually an attribution of her personality.
Mm.
So to me, it's actually kind of deep. It's. I think I could argue that it's not superficial,
mm-hmm.
but that's just, again, this is like, I find, I mean, don't get me wrong, like a girl, like a model who, like, see, like, most models are in shape,
mm-hmm.
but obviously, don't get me wrong, there's a fine line between in shape and, like, bulimic or, like, unhealthy, you know, and I don't find that attractive, but yeah, I don't know, like, I don't think it's a crime to say that I like a girl who can take care of herself. And again, not to say that there are some people who are overweight who do take care of themselves and can't lose the weight,
right,
but it's an easy assumption for me to make, to limit the billions of factors that go into, like, deciding whether, you know, a girl or a guy is a good candidate for you.
Right. That's interesting. So that's an emotional reason. Do you kind of spoke to also, like, you know, biological, instinctive reasons as to why people are more sexually attracted to people who are in shape.
Well, I am definitely no biology expert, but if I could piece together the little amount that I know from the coursework that I took between college, high school, and just random, you know, Snapple facts.
Personal study, yeah.
Yeah. It's almost an instinctive evolutionarily, like, adaptation for us to, it's like almost even subconscious, mm-hmm. for us to categorize the attractiveness of a woman or a man based on certain attributes that are, like, way deeper in regards to the subtlety of what it means than, like, we might even realize. So what I mean is, like, ultimately, if I find a girl attractive,
mm-hmm.
I would like to assume, based on, like, things I learned, is that, like, not only do I find her attractive, but, like, my very, like, deep-rooted evolutionary adaptation is telling me this would make a good candidate to have, to reproduce with, to have a child with, mm-hmm. a healthy child with.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's part societal and part evolutionary, part societal, yes, and part based on, because of evolution, that is that a girl who might not be overweight, well, it's a fact that, it is a fact that obesity is a disease. It's a fact that obesity is associated with many, many comorbidities. And that is a scientific fact. I mean, that is my work and my job. I'm around obese people, patients all the time. And so I learn a lot about, you know, between hypertension and heart problems and diabetes, asthma, it exacerbates a lot of comorbidities. It starts a lot of comorbidities. So
what is the word you're saying?
Comorbidities is just saying, like, diseases on top of whatever else you got that are associated with each other.
Right.
So to me, it's a two-part thing. Like, so obesity, I could assume that you're less healthy if you're obese as opposed to if you were, like, in shape. And, like, I'm not trying to sound like an asshole. Like, this is a scientific fact. And not to say that you can't be healthy being like overweight. And I'm not talking about, I guess, I mean, you could be a little like fat and not be obese, but still the fatter you get, the less healthy you are. Mm-hmm. And for me, I think there's a very like deep rooted subconscious thing where it's like, I want to find a mate that could give me the healthiest baby. Mm-hmm. So therefore, like, I need the healthiest mate. Mm-hmm. And that's the same thing with women. They judge men on a multitude of things that I can argue are more superficial than the whole weight issue. And this is kind of an off topic, but I did mention this to you, Joe, and that was that girls find men to be superficial when they base a woman's attractiveness based on her weight, which does have some... That does resonate in some factor, like in some, there is some actual depth and reality to that. But I know that there's some people who literally can't lose weight unless they have surgery or something. Mm-hmm. But it is a fact that weight is more controllable than height is.
Right.
Height is the ultimate arbitrary, congenital thing you can get from your parents.
Yeah, you don't, right? Have, like, you can't, it's a trait you don't have control over.
You can work on your shape, you can work on the body, like you can work on your fat content, you can work on your muscle content, you can work on whatever, but you can't get taller, you can't get shorter. And I always hear every day, not every day, but a lot of times, women will say, I can never date a guy shorter than me.
Right. Just like a guy would say, I can't date a girl heavier than me.
Exactly. And Vanessa brought up the point that she thinks that it's kind of like a societal shame thing if you date a fat girl. And I think that applies the same way with guys. Mm-hmm. That, like, it's a societal shame thing if a girl's with a guy who's shorter than she is. Mm-hmm. And I think that's even shittier, though. And I don't want to call that out. And, I mean...
Because we have no control.
Thankfully, I am 6'3", like, very, very grateful for that. I've yet to really meet, like I think one girl, like, in person, face-to-face, talk.
I just lost you for like a second. You met a girl face to face, and then I lost you.
I'm just saying, like I can't really speak because it's not like I've met a girl who was taller than me.
You met like one girl.
I've never
girl.
Really been in the position. Maybe, yeah. But it's definitely something that I run into a lot, and I have a lot of short friends, and they tell me that too. Mm-hmm. And not to say there are some women who are tall who will say, I'll date a guy who's shorter than me. Just like there are some guys who are. You know, whatever, and let's say I'll date a fat girl. I don't care. Mm-hmm. And then my last, go ahead.
No,
you have like a question.
No,
or a follow-up?
No, go ahead. Say what you're gonna say.
My last thing is back to the evolutionary thing. Mm-hmm. The evolution thing is there's also, I remember reading this, there are some attributes that men and women look for in each other that very subtly, deep rooted, kind of convey the probability of a better outcome for them. And so for a woman.
For reproduction, for a guy, you're talking about.
So what I mean is, for a guy looking at a girl, like guys, you hear all the time, like fucking in, like in songs, like it's very known that like it's very known that guys like a girl with small hips. Yes, exactly. a small waist and a fat butt. That's like.
Well, I mean, if you have wide hips and a small waist, aren't you more capable of like birthing a child? Isn't that better for birth?
Exactly.
So it's like instinctual thing. It's like a.
It is, and if you realize like why do women have wider hips than men? If men are generally wider and bigger, it's because men don't have to we don't have to birth a child. Yeah. Women do, and for us, I think as men, it's very instinctual. We see like a woman with bigger hips kind of conveys like the ability to bear a child. Mm-hmm. And so and a girl with big boobs too. I mean, I met many guys who were like, I don't really care about boobs, mm-hmm. but the instinctual like subtlety is a woman with bigger breasts mean that she can, you know, take care of the child more, mm-hmm. like the guy's son or the guy's daughter can, you know, feed them and whatever. And that could be wrong, but there is some logic behind those assumptions. Mm-hmm. And that goes to the same thing with a woman. She wants a tall guy, right? She wants a guy with broad shoulders who's hairy or not hairy, maybe. That's like kind of a societal thing. But the bigger the guy, almost, the more attractive he is. Mm-hmm. And then that's almost the same thing. It's because a guy and not to sound patriarchal or like I don't really care like I'm if I get called out for this, but there's absolute truth to a guy is like the physical, you know, gatekeeper, I want to say, of like a relationship. Like, mm-hmm. and it doesn't apply to every relationship, but men are physically bigger than women, right?
Yeah.
So it's really because of that, more likely that a guy's role is to protect the family more than it is a woman's role.
Mm-hmm.
Not to say that it doesn't flip sometimes, but generally
that's
a guy's bigger.
That's so, the normative thing.
Yes, it is. And that's absolute fact. I mean, like, not to sound like an asshole or to not sound like an asshole, whatever. Mm-hmm. I don't really care. But a guy being bigger by a guy with bigger shoulders means the likelihood of him being able to protect the family better.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a woman might find a guy attractive who has broader shoulders or bigger muscles or taller figure. Might not really even realize that's why she wants that, but that's attractive to her.
Mm-hmm.
And that's fair, because there is some logic behind it. So I think it goes a lot deeper. Well, I think my general point is that I think there's a lot deeper instinctual and emotional and logical almost like factors that come into when a guy or a girl is looking at another mate and deciding whether they're attractive in that split second.
So it may not be completely that bad. It may not be that superficial for us to like really good-looking girls or what society deems as really good-looking.
Yeah, I mean, because ultimately it really falls down on your kid. You know, you pick a good-looking woman, the probability of your kid being good-looking is probably bigger.
Mm-hmm.
You pick an ugly-looking woman, it's the vice versa. But to deem what is ugly and good-looking is definitely a societal
mm-hmm.
decision.
It,
I mean, in terms of like a face, you know, I don't know. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know why I find some girls' faces more attractive than others.
Yeah.
I know the whole symmetry thing has some resonance behind it, but like, I don't know.
Yeah. Another thing I didn't mention in my conversation with Vanessa is I heard about some study people who studied, like primates, and they had like chimpanzees with like gorillas who were like kind of, on the higher end of the chain of like genetic superiority, kind of like right under
like
human
bigger,
beings.
Like,
yeah, they were bigger and muscular, and they like looked like ripped like these gorillas.
Yeah.
And the chimpanzees were like marveled by the bigger gorillas. Like they kind of were like focused
right.
on them, and like the gorillas were like paid no mind to the chimpanzees who were like a little
yeah.
more lanky and like. So it's weird. I mean, it is
Well, you make a great point. I mean, think about it like this. Like, you see on National Geographic, the ram with the bigger horns, the gorilla with the bigger, you know, muscles, the lion that's the biggest is the one that's going to get the mates. And and the logic behind that is because the guy who could fend off all the other guys is probably the guy who's most likely able to fend off everyone else.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what makes him attractive.
Mm-hmm.
And I think even though that doesn't really apply in our reality anymore as humans, because like physicality isn't really a factor as to whether, you know, you'll make it in life or not in
mm-hmm.
terms of, you know, like money is now what arbitrates those kind of things.
Mm-hmm.
It's still, I mean, it's been millions and millions of years of this law applying to humans or whatever we came from. So I think there's still some overlap. There's still some, you know, like leftover
mm-hmm.
from that.
It's carried over a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, Stav, it's all interesting. It's all good. I appreciate it. If there's anyone listening to this who, well, I want to try to keep this conversation going, or maybe even like expand it into other conversations about gender, if there's like females out there who want to give two cents about anything involving that, I would love to keep some type of dialogue about this stuff going, because I think...
Yeah, please. I'd love to learn how much of a jackass I am by what I just said. If a woman can come back, or a man, you know, can call me out on some things, I might be ignorant too.
Yeah.
But Joe, what you're doing is awesome. Keep it up.
Oh, thanks, man. I appreciate you doing it. Appreciate you doing it. How's your week looking?
It's going to be... I got to get up mad early tomorrow, but it's going to be good. It's going to be a good week.
All right, man.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah,
I'll talk to you. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks, man.
All right.
Thanks for calling me.
I'll talk to you.
Later.
So long. All right. Thank you, Stav, for doing that, for continuing that dialogue. I think it's an interesting topic and something that people don't, like we said, people shy away from talking about that kind of thing. So to have Stav talk about it in such a candid and real way. Sorry, I just burped. I think is refreshing. And if, like we said, if there's anyone who wants to continue that conversation, please feel free to contact me, and I'd love to keep that going. But now we're going to go to my conversation, the main part of this podcast, my conversation with Tom Salerno. Tom grew up in my town. Tom is, I don't want to give too much away, I don't want to give too much of a preface to this one, but Tom is someone who's done a lot in the young life that he's had so far. He's experienced a lot more than the normal 23-year-old has experienced in terms of what he's done professionally and also what he's had to go through personally. And I think he has had a very interesting story so far. And I think he's a very atypical 23-year-old with a lot of different ideas and a different way of him than the average 23-year-old, as he will admit as well. I really enjoyed having this conversation with Tom. So I hope you enjoy listening to it. Here he is, Tom Salerno.
Yeah,
that's
for you.
Sure. Sorry. I'm very tired.
I'm sure you are.
In the city.
What were you doing?
You can turn the chair. I was terrible. You don't have to sit like caddy corner. We're recording already, but we can start whenever. What were you asking?
What were you doing in the city?
Is this even? Hello. I can't hear myself. What was I doing in the city? I was. Hello. Okay, that's better. Yeah, I was. I saw two shows at UCB, one at 7 p.m. and one at 10 p.m. in the East Village. The first one was a completely improvised musical, like an hour-long musical. So they had like little scenes, and then every now and then, at certain plot points, they would like break out and improvise a song on the spot.
Very cool.
Yeah, and it was like, it was funny, but it was more so like, amazing to watch them like be able to improvise like legitimate songs off the top of their heads.
Right.
Yeah. But anyway, how you doing?
I'm doing great.
Yeah.
It's been a long time.
Yeah. See, this is all right. So I have you been? Do you know anything about this podcast? We didn't even talk. I just asked if you wanted to come on.
I listened to it a bunch of times.
Yeah.
I really liked Mustafa's comments about, you know, growing up Muslim. Post 9/11, I'm really interested in 9/11 as a history teacher.
Oh well, yeah.
So I watched that, but
yeah,
so I'm familiar with the millennial format.
Well, yeah, I was. I say sometimes in this podcast that I'm glad I'm doing it because one, it's giving me an excuse to talk to people who are friends of mine, but that I don't normally see that often, and then also people who I'm like not still super like in touch with and giving me a chance to see like re get in touch with, right. Like people like Dana Karuba, right. Like I just,
yeah, we never really hung out in high school.
No, I mean, not we did a lot of extracurriculars together,
right?
We did theater together,
right?
And we butt heads because we were both stubborn as hell,
and we were very successful at our show.
Well, yeah, and we both wanted a good product.
And we did great.
And we both
good times.
Yeah,
good time. Very proud of the work we did.
Yeah, you were the director for all 4 years. So there's this thing in our school called, our high school called One Acts, which is just each grade puts on a 30-minute play, freshman, sophomore, junior, senior, and it's like a competition. They give out awards for like best overall production, best director, best supporting and lead actor, actress, that kind of stuff. And our grade won our junior and senior year, which is a thing that doesn't usually happen. Usually the seniors only win.
It was highly controversial.
Highly controversial. Pull that mic a little closer to your face.
Okay.
I put the volume up, but it's
okay. Better. Am I better now?
Yeah, that's better.
Okay.
Yeah, highly controversial.
I lost a lot of friends in the grade above us when we whooped them.
We didn't whip. What was it?
It was a blowout. And everybody knew it.
I remember you got... They announced best director before best production. I was like, oh, wow, Tom won best director.
Right.
Like maybe they thought ours was good enough that they'll give us best director and they'll just give them best production.
Right.
And then when they gave us best production, my jaw was on the
floor.
Yeah,
everyone went crazy. Yeah. It was a great, great night. But our senior show was the one I was most proud of.
Yeah.
Because that's the one that we all wrote together.
Yeah.
And it was a great show. Does anyone still have the DVD of that? Because I would love to see it.
I don't
it.
Know. I hope.
Maybe
I
Rosano has it. He yeah. keeps things like that. I would love to see it all these years later.
Yeah, I knew McMichael had the junior, like a videotape of the junior one.
I have the junior one at
home. I might want to borrow that.
Absolutely.
Because the junior play was Law and Order Fairy Tale Unit, and it was just like a Law and Order investigation of the destruction of the Three Little Pigs houses.
A lot better than it sounds. It was fantastic.
And I played a gay pig, and my friend Kev McMichael, who's been on the show, played like a chain smoker pig, and he would talk like, "Hey, how are you?" Like that kind of voice.
That's one of the reasons why we were so successful, because we had extremely talented kids in our grade.
Yeah.
You, McMichael, Catherine Chapman, Joe Rosano, yeah. Dana Karuba, yeah. Fantastic young actors and actresses. And I tried to let you guys do as much
yeah.
independent of me directing you. So that was yeah. one of the good things that came out of that, when you were able to improvise your entire character start
yeah.
to finish.
Yeah. That was the thing that was controversial, is that normally only the senior year you can write, and we kind of changed some characters.
We bent the rules. We never cheated. We bent the rules.
Bent the rules. Yeah, I remember going back to us being stubborn and butting heads sometimes. I remember freshman year, I remember during practice, like us getting in an argument or something, and you being like, "All right, you direct it. You direct it how you think it should happen. Let's see, just do it. Just improvise it and direct it along the way." And I remember we did like a whole, probably like a quarter of the play. And then the next time we rehearsed, you were like, no, none of what we did last time. And I was like, "Tom, you, you asshole." But it was probably better.
In fact, I specifically remember you using that language. And it's funny years later.
Yeah.
But yeah, we were both very talented, very opinionated, stubborn guys.
Yeah, to yeah, an extent,
yeah. I'm sure we still are.
Yeah.
But
that definitely came out senior year. Do you remember the process of senior year of like getting
yeah, so
to the
process of senior year? Basically, for your viewers who I'm sure have no idea what we're talking about with 1X, basically senior year, you get to write your own show. And it's usually the director and the quote unquote producers mm-hmm. take a leading role in that. So what I did was I basically said to the top people in our cast, "You guys write it. Mm-hmm. I'll help facilitate, but you guys mm-hmm. could be the creative minds behind mm-hmm. it." So Joe and I think Kevin McMichael mm-hmm. and that core group, Dana and Catherine, really yeah. wrote it. And I was just kind of there. Oh, and Chris Greco was there.
Yeah, Chris Greco.
And I was just sort of there helping along logistically, but you guys did a phenomenal amount of work on that.
I remember at first what the big discrepancy was that the only idea at first that we had was we wanted to do like a parody of The Wizard of Oz or
yep.
something.
Yeah.
And I like wanted to strive to do, so the cliche thing was that senior year they would always do a play about the school and like with characters as the teachers, and it just kind of, by the time the grade above us did it, it was like stale a little bit. And then we wanted to do something different, and I was championing for like a completely original idea, not a parody of anything, not based off anything. And I remember you gave me and Kev McMichael an ultimatum.
Oh, did I? I don't remember this.
And like we had a meeting, and like it was like 50-50. Like some people wanted the Wizard of Oz, and then some people were like, "Let's try to keep trying to figure out another idea." And you're like, "Well, you got to come up with one, or we're going with the other one." And I remember I was at Kev McMichael's indoor soccer game, and I was like coaching, quote unquote, meaning I was just sitting on the sideline because they needed an official quote.
Right.
And we were just spit talking, And Kev just was like, "What if we're just board of directors?" And then he got up and went into the game. And I just came up with this yeah. whole idea on the spot of
yeah.
we're all different board of directors. We're on stage yeah. the whole time. And we have this kind of company that's a food company that's going bankrupt. And we have one last shot to make a product that'll save our company. And it was a gum that ultimately ended up killing people when we were testing it on people.
And it was a fabulous idea, outstanding show. And, you know, as somebody who at the time
yeah.
thought, you know, Wizard of Oz would be cool, having like a GPS directing them around. Yeah, there was some cute stuff, but it was cute. And that was the problem.
Yeah.
You know, like, Joe's idea was to do a show that wasn't cute, that could pass for a legitimate theater.
Yeah.
And it was fantastic. Yeah. We actually brought in a friend of mine who's a professional actress to help work with the show a little at the end.
Oh, yeah.
So Lori Rose Osborne who's a local actress, helped us out, and yeah, I was really proud of the work we did. You know, I got handed a fabulous script and did my best to make sure it looked good on stage.
When you look back at that, those 4 years, that experience was in that role of director, like, what do you think is the biggest takeaway that applies to how you worked as, like, maybe a managerial role or like a facilitator, any type of like professional situation? Like, what was the best thing you took from all those experiences?
Well,
as director, you're the leader.
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. It was definitely a formative experience in my life. It's one of the best parts of high school for me, and looking back on memories, and you know, I've gone on to do things where I've taken a leadership role, and yeah, I definitely learned a lot about myself, and I learned about letting go a little bit of control and having to work with a team.
Yeah.
And yeah, I learned a lot about how you get to the end result through working with a diverse group of people who have different backgrounds and opinions. And and yeah, it served me very well in my professional life.
Yeah, a quote I've heard from podcasts is like a big part of like growing up is understanding and acknowledging what your limitations are. And I think when you work in a group, you realize like things that other people are better at or things that you are better at than other people, and can kind of figure out the best way you work.
And I had a great partner.
Joe
Rosano was my producer for four years, and he was outstanding.
I mean, he was just a workhorse.
I'm sure he still is. I think he's doing pharmacy at wherever he is. I'm sure he's very successful at it. But he did all the logistical back, you know, and I did all the creative stuff. So we were a great team, and we had a great group.
Mm-hmm. So this is interesting to me because this is probably the longest we've talked since high school.
Right.
And like I said, we didn't have like a...
we weren't close friends. We were friendly. I don't think we ever had any major conflicts.
The great thing that you think of, I mean, when I think back on high school is our class was so small that you would interact with like all different types of people. Like, yeah, sure, there were still the people you interacted with more, but like since the school was so small, like just because I didn't hang out with you in class or outside of class didn't mean that like if I was in your English honors class, I wouldn't like talk to you.
Right.
Like, I remember
And you were at my father's wake. You and I think Bo and Mustafa were all there, which I thought was very touching. So even when you grow up in a small town, you start to realize even if you're not hanging out with people, you know, on Friday nights, Saturdays, you know, people are still, you know, there for you when you need people. So
when you look back, what if you can get yourself into the mindset of your senior year?
Oh God.
Yeah.
Go back to that.
Yeah.
This is not a pretty time in my life. I was still wearing glasses and was considerably more dorky than I am now.
Yeah. You seem much more, present in yourself. Like you seem like more like, like a little more relaxed and a little more composed and less like...
I've mellowed with age.
Yeah. So what was your perception of what you wanted college to be when you're going... You went to Rutgers?
Yeah, I went to Rutgers. I graduated Rutgers last year with my degree in political science and education.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a grad student now at Rutgers, getting my master's in social studies education.
Wow.
So, I love Rutgers. Fantastic school. Mm-hmm.
And you had a bit of an atypical...
At a very atypical.
So, do you mind taking me through that all? Because I don't know like the timeline of it.
Sure. So, I guess your initial question is, what did I want my college experience to be like? And I guess the answer 18
year old Tom, you're like, I'm going to Rutgers.
Completely
for this.
Different.
Yeah.
Than my high school experience.
You know,
I wasn't one of the cool kids.
Yeah.
I never hung out. Actually, that's not true. One day in college, Jenna Torsha and
Joe
Rosano invited me to one of the party at their house. It was like the big thing, Tom Salerno to party. So I did party with the cool kids once.
Ooh, cool.
So I get that on my resume. but I wanted to go to Rutgers and be in a massive school coming from a small town.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted it to be completely different than high school.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, sort of. Mm-hmm. The background is my father had gotten sick.
Right.
With a disease called amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, aka ALS, or more commonly known as Lou Gehrig's disease.
Right.
You might remember ALS from that ice bucket challenge two years ago when everyone was dumping ice water over
their head.
That
phenomenon.
Right. And, but that's a conversation for another day.
Yeah.
So my dad got sick the summer before my junior year of high school.
Oh, was that early?
Yeah, it was early. And he was sick for 3 years before he passed away. Mm-hmm. And ALS is a rough disease. you know, you lose control of all your muscles. His particular version of it, he couldn't speak, couldn't swallow, couldn't eat. So it was rough. That's,
but I always saw him running outside.
Yeah, he was, you know,
Tom
he was a big runner.
Tom, you didn't have to walk that far to.
No, Joe and I grew up 10 houses from each other or something like that. I mean, you could almost see my house.
Yeah.
Not quite.
Yeah.
But anyway, so my father had gotten sick. We had a conversation. I decided I was going to go to Rutgers, try to have a normal experience. Mm-hmm. And as he got sicker, it became clear that he needed someone to help take care of him. And my dad was a very private guy. He had been a fireman for the Clifton Fire Department for like 26 years. Mm-hmm. Very proud. So I decided to take a year off from Rutgers to come home and take care of him. Mm-hmm. Turned out it was only a semester because he died.
This was your sophomore year?
This was my freshman year.
Oh, wow.
So I left Rutgers right after the first semester, December-ish. And was with my dad taking care of him full time, you know, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. Until March 11th, 2012, which is when he passed away. And it was rough, you know. It was rough on my sister, who's 5 years younger than me, so she was 13 at the time. But anyway, so went back to Rutgers in the fall, in September. And I started to get interested in education.
Right.
For whatever reason. My father had been a fireman. My mom was a nurse.
Right.
So I wanted to do something with my life that would help others.
Right.
So I decided to run for the Board of Education in Bukwanik.
Right. So I'm curious. Let's back up a little. How, and I don't want to like make you have to like, you know, talk about this too much.
It's really not a problem. Okay. So, no one asks. So it's, you know, it's an opportunity.
I'm just wondering how, you know, dealing with that experience kind of changed your mindset going back.
It didn't change my mindset, but it forced me to grow up. Really, really quick. Basically, I had to take on the head of the household role. My mom, as I said, is a nurse. She's at a local hospital here in Bukwanik.
She's at Chilton.
Oh, yeah. Wow. Has been for forever.
Wow.
And, you know, my dad retired, so he had a pension, but my mom still needed to work to support the family.
Mm-hmm.
And the other issue with my dad's illness was, you know, he needed 24-hour constant care because he couldn't move.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he couldn't speak. He had to get repositioned, all kinds of physical stuff.
Repositioned?
I'd have to like pick him up. Take him to use the bathroom. You know, it was a lot of physical labor.
It was the same thing my grandma kind of when she was a quadriplegic.
So. It's rough. Yeah, and I'm sorry. She passed away relatively recently, right?
Yeah, my senior year of college.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear that.
Yeah, she made it a while.
Yeah, she did. I remember she was, you know.
She got hit. She got hit by a car when I was in fifth grade, and she was in that state for a long time.
That's right. But anyway, so my mom had to work, and she was working like the 3 to 11 shift.
Right.
And she would come home, and she needed to sleep
because
she couldn't do it 24 hours. So I would take the night shift. She would take the day shift. So I was up with my father every single night. And, you know, forced you to grow up really, really quick and to realize what your priorities in life had to be.
That's a weird thing having to, at such a young age when, I mean, especially where, you know, we're of an age group and in a generation where parents kind of reinforced to us to like worry about yourselves and to put yourselves first and to kind of, I mean, that's maybe I'm painting with a broad brush, but for you to like realize as like an 18-year-old that, I mean, I'm sure your parents weren't like down your neck of being like, hey, dad's in this situation, we need your help. It was, I'm sure, knowing your character, that you were the one who kind of initiated the, I think this is where my duty is.
That's exactly right. You know, my parents were older. My dad was
50. Admirable is what I'm saying.
Thank you. I appreciate that. My parents were older. My dad was 54 when he died. My mom's 56 now.
Mm-hmm.
So they had me late in life. Mm-hmm. And my grandparents on my father's side also had my dad late in life. So I think they had values that were a little older than their contemporaries and their generation. So, we were always
more traditional.
Your
dad was a fireman and your mom was a nurse.
Exactly. So, you know, I grew up with very traditional values. And yeah, family really became the big obligation. And I was very, you know, I was very proud of the work I did for my father. You know, he had a very peaceful passing. You know, he was petrified with ALS because basically the end stage of ALS is your lungs stop working. And you have two options, either go on a ventilator or you die. And and he chose to not go on the vent. But he was very afraid. So I was able to be there for him through the whole thing, and it was a very peaceful, you know, end.
Did you see a more significant in his like later years, did you see any type of more significant positive change in him? Not positive, but like kind of like an interesting takeaway in the way in which like maybe it affected him?
It's funny you say that because my sister, who again is 5 years older than me, was the baby of the family and was dad's favorite. I mean, my sister and my father did everything together. And it caused some conflict for me growing up to be, you know, not the favorite.
Right.
For the first time in my young life, my dad needed me. So it was, you know, we had a much better relationship with him being sick just because there was more of a mutual respect for both of us as individuals. And I wasn't just, you know, the boy anymore. I was the son who, you know, could take care of him where Allie couldn't. And also Allie couldn't emotionally deal with it. You know, she was a kid and, you know, rightly so. What 13, 14 year old kid should have to go through what I went through. But I mean, I did everything. I waited my father's booty, you know, I took him, moved him from his bed to the chair and visit, you know, so it was sad. It was devastating. It was depressing. But, you know, as an adult, I'm proud of doing what I did and not staying at college.
So then you go back.
Then I go back, which was fun until I got sort of bored. I don't know. I wanted to do something meaningful because I guess I went through sort of a depression after my father died because I no longer really had a purpose. You know,
What was the specifics of the thinking of that?
I don't know. It's not one of those logical things, but I remember being depressed most of that summer because, you know, for a long time I had been necessary. Somebody's life depended on me. Somebody needed me. Suddenly I was just, you know, I had fun that summer, but then once, you know, hung out with family a lot, went to the shore, did a whole bunch of trips, went to Oregon. But then once life settled back to normal, it was sort of meaningless. It was weird.
No, it's not weird. I mean, I think I've talked about something similar to that, is that, you know, Stephen Colbert, I've talked about this multiple times on the podcast. He's not a hero, but he's good. He's good. But he lost multiple family members of his father and siblings, multiple siblings. And he said after it was like everything got put in this weird, distorted, kind of almost comedic perspective of like everything.
Yeah, well, not to be overly morbid, but my grandfather died 2 weeks later.
Yeah.
From a broken heart on my father's side. And then 2 weeks after
his father?
Yeah, my dad's father. Then 2 weeks after that, my mother's mother died. So, yeah, 2012 was a rough. You know, they said 2012 was going to be the end of the world. And it wasn't, but it was sort of.
For you.
Yeah. Got very, very friendly with the funeral owners in Clifton Shook's funeral home.
Hey, it's me again.
Fantastic.
Oh, my God.
Fantastic funeral home. Good people.
Oh, God.
So, somewhat similar.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so you go back and you feel like I did all this meaningful thing. It's kind of like although it's hard and difficult, it's almost life affirming because you have a purpose, you have a higher need in the universe. So then when after it's just like, okay, now I have to just do it for myself.
Yeah. I went back to just being me.
Yeah.
You know, unimportant and sort of the way I felt in high school. Sort of not seen.
Yeah.
But anyway, so I was home every other weekend, taking care of stuff around the house, helping mom out. And I had always been interested in local politics in town, specifically the school stuff.
Yeah.
Because I was very unhappy towards the end of my education with the way things were going.
Towards the end of our high school?
Towards the end of our
high school.
So
what was your thought process about?
Oh, God. You're going to get me in trouble.
No. I mean, say only what you want. I mean, but.
I'll tell you the truth. there were certain people leading our school district.
You're talking about that fucker, that motherfucker principal we had?
There was a principal.
What's his name? Gargiola, that fucking cocksucker.
See, I wasn't going to say anybody's
If you're listening,
name.
I don't care. I don't care. Fuck you.
Yeah,
you're a piece of shit.
He had very different views on education than I do. Let's just say that.
Yeah. Sorry. That's.
You can tell I'm a local politician, can't you?
Oh, God.
Anyway, there was a real emphasis on standardized testing at the expense of arts and music and other important areas of the curriculum.
It's a statewide thing, too, isn't it?
Of course it is.
Connie?
Of course, it's a national. Christy. It's a national issue.
Fucking Christy.
Well, so anyway, so I was very critical of that and got interested, you know, started going to board meetings, paying mm-hmm. attention, listening for things. At that time, there was a new superintendent
mm-hmm.
who had never been a teacher or a principal before. He came sort of from the private sector,
right.
became a school business administrator who runs all the money stuff, mm. and then became superintendent.
Right. I heard complaints of like, right. we're not making toasters, we're making people. He ran it like a business.
That's exactly right. So so I got interested, started going to board meetings, and decided that, well, you know, I want to be on the board. I had always wanted to be on the board as a kid.
How old are you this time?
At this time, I was 19.
Which is highly irregular.
It's highly, yeah, of course it is. You know, 19-year-old kid decides he's going to run for the board? Everyone's like, oh, that's so cute, but he's never going to win.
When was it an actual realized idea of, like, I think I want to actually do, you know?
November of 2012.
This is what your sophomore year would be?
Right.
Yeah.
Very beginning of my sophomore year of college.
Right. But where were you? Were you taking classes at this point?
So, yeah, I'm taking classes. I'm living at Rutgers.
But it's your second semester.
It's my second semester, beginning of second year. So I got thrown off the regular timeline. Mm-hmm. And coming home every other weekend, every weekend. So I'm kind of in between two worlds.
Yeah.
I'm at home, but I'm at Rutgers. And mm-hmm. both have some advantages. At the time, I was involved at Rutgers mock trial, which was, at that point, the second best team nationally.
Oh, wow.
So it was a great program to some very...
It was first.
If you think I was stubborn in high school, these people never grew out of that. They were very intense, extremely talented, bright, intense people.
That shit's crazy.
And anyway, because I was turned off to their personalities, I decided I didn't want to be a lawyer. My life, I wanted to be a lawyer.
Oh, I didn't know if I knew that was what you wanted to do.
Yeah, that's what I was planning on. I was in mock trial in high school.
Right.
Was very interested in that. So I was going to school at Rutgers to be a lawyer.
Right.
You know, get a good political science background, and then go on to law school. So I had to make a decision. Yeah. I was either going to run for the board and kind of risk my future on this idea that I might or may not want to be involved in education and government and public policy, or stay at Rutgers and forget about this pipe dream of being on the board and just, you know, go to law school.
Yeah.
So I decided to run for the board.
Yeah.
And said,
see
you later, mock trial.
What got you to that point? Just because...
Honestly, the encouragement of some really respected people.
Mm.
I had a couple former teachers who I'm still very close with now who encouraged me to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one had retired, but a couple were still teaching in mm-hmm. the district, and they were very, very unhappy with the direction the district was going. And I knew my dad would be proud if I won. Mm-hmm. And if he was alive, he never would have let me. He would have told me, be practical, go to law school, you know, make enough money so that you can have an, you know, happy, comfortable life and don't get involved in this stupidity.
Yeah.
So that's what I did. I decided to run and...
I remember when I saw it on like social media, I was like, what?
Yeah, I
Tom?
So the reason... So the thing is, in most
there's
towns,
like 40-year-olds and right. like 50, it's like...
For your viewers who have absolutely... Or listeners who have absolutely no interest in local government and couldn't care less, let me just say, every town has a board of education. And most times... People just kind of sign up to do it.
Mm-hmm.
Older people of kids in the district who want to get involved just put their name in and they're typically running a post.
Mm-hmm.
It's not the way it works in small town America in Bequanic because every time there's an election, it's a big deal.
Mm-hmm. My dad's the mayor.
Right. Joe's dad is the mayor. So I decide I'm going to run for the board, hoping and praying that no one is going to like figure it out and run against me, thinking I can get it under the radar type of deal. And of course, that's not what happened. There is a political power group in town who really didn't want a 19-year-old kid on the Board of Education who, you know, may or may not have seen exactly what things are like on the inside and want to kind of maintain the status quo.
Hmm.
So they get four people to run against me. So here's me, little old 19-year-old outspoken kid running against four adults for the Board of Education. And
so
everyone has given me,
like
you're
Disney
so
movie.
Cute. It's so nice that you're going to do this, but don't be disappointed when you lose.
Yeah.
Because some other young people had tried to run.
Right.
A very good friend of mine from high school got defeated
Tom
badly. No, Gianna Hall.
Oh,
she
I didn't
ran,
know she ran.
Yeah, she ran.
She's mad at me right now.
She's mad at you?
I think.
Did you interview her?
No. She was lovely and got me some gig that I just... turned down by just like stopping responding because I was like, I don't want to do this, but know how to disengage this conversation. So I kind of strung her along and made her seem like I'm an idiot.
Well, she was in love with you. Oh God.
Oh no, no, no.
The whole town will know. Yeah, it was cute. We were in middle school. Best years of my life in middle school.
Oh, Mr. Foth.
Yeah, oh God. Fantastic music teacher. Anyway, where was I? So other young people had run for the board and been defeated terribly.
Yeah.
So people didn't take it very seriously. Mm-hmm. But I'm not your typical 19-year-old. So I get business cards. I put flyers up over the town. I get signs for my lawns. Mm-hmm. I have social media game going. And
was there any like really ridiculous kind of passive aggressive, like, oh, good for you, but like, you'll never, it won't happen.
There was a aggressive issue.
Yeah.
That I can talk about now, I think, because I'm almost done on the board. Mm-hmm. And basically,
with your term or like,
what? Yeah, my term. My term is up in January and I'm not running for reelection. Mm-hmm. Even though I could get reelected easily, I got to focus on starting my career in education. Mm-hmm. Right now, I'm doing my student teaching in Booton, New Jersey at John Hill School, teaching 8th grade middle school, and I love it. And it's a fantastic little building. And, it's very hard to be a board member and a teacher at the same time.
Right.
So I'm going to focus on my career for a while and then maybe go back to local politics in a decade or so. Mm. But there was an aggressive thing that happened. I am very good at Photoshop. Always was. So I had a friend of mine take a picture of me in front of the high school marquee. Sign in front of the high school where they say, like, basketball game tonight or whatever. And using Photoshop, I superimposed my campaign slogan onto the sign.
Right.
So the superintendent at the time felt that implied that the school district was supporting me.
Yeah.
And didn't want me to use that in my campaign materials. And, of course, it's on my business card, it's on my website, it's on social media, so my picture's out there with the superimposed thing.
Yeah.
And they send me a cease and desist letter.
What?
Yeah, like legitimate, the school district's lawyer sends me a cease and desist order. And my mom freaks out. Oh my God, you're gonna get arrested, you're not doing this, I told you this was a stupid idea.
You're gonna get arrested.
So up till that point, I was just kind of annoyed. Yeah, oh God, well, you know my mom a little bit, she's like, ultra germ phobe.
Yeah.
You know, don't do anything.
Yeah.
I wasn't allowed to like ride my bike without a helmet ever.
Yeah.
I wasn't allowed to ride my bike till I turned 16. Part of the reasons I never got invited to parties. Anyway, my reaction was different. I was mad. Because not only did they have four people running against me, like obviously trying to see me defeated, but now they were involving like lawyers.
Legality issues.
So I decided, well, no one's going to bully me. My father never allowed anyone to bully me as a kid. I wasn't going to allow adults to bully me. So I got my own lawyer. And there was a legal battle that resulted in an ethics charge against the board president at the time, which, truth is, he didn't do much wrong. The board president and I disagreed on a number of things, but I don't think he was directly involved in this.
Yeah.
But it was sort of unethical for the superintendent to have a lawyer send me a cease and desist letter where the superintendent could have just called me on the phone and said, hey, listen, I think it's great you're running for the board, but why don't you take this? Exactly.
Like,
exactly. Be a professional.
Just came back with a lawyer and we're like,
yeah, you know, I'm Italian. So anyway, oh yeah, I don't look it, you know.
Was that was your dad's side Italian?
Yeah. Well, my last name is Salerno.
Yeah.
You know, I'm as Italian. I make my own pasta, my mom's German.
Mm. That's what I am, Italian German. Yeah,
right. But and pasta is like the fifth food group, except I'm gluten free now. So
are you?
I can't eat pasta.
Is it celiacs or is it?
It's an intolerance. Mm-hmm. You know, thank God I don't have celiacs, but I've lost some weight. Lost about 15 pounds since I went gluten free in August. So major depression that I can't eat pasta. I make my own sauce.
Dude, pasta is my favorite food.
Sauce.
And I don't eat it anymore.
Becoming an adult, yes.
Yeah.
Anyway, so I run
whole wheat pasta every now and then, right? It's not bad for you. I know it's not the same.
It's not the same. Like, I literally make my own with the flour and make the little well with the egg, and I run it through the pasta machine and make linguine. I'm like the whitest Italian you've ever seen in your life. Part of the reason why I never get a date, too. So going back to the election.
I don't have dates either, man.
Yeah. You know me.
Yeah.
So anyway, going back to the election, I campaign hard.
Mm-hmm.
I had been working at Cedar Crest, which is a little retirement village up north of town. I shouldn't say little because there's about 5,000 people who live there. and got many of them to vote for me.
They're like the Ohio of our town.
They're like the Ohio of Bukwanek. They can swing an election, and I knew it, and I campaigned.
That's what my dad was worried about with the council, and he's like, I don't know, man, Cedar Crest.
Right, you know, they have a lot of power, and there's a lot of nice, lovely
old people. They just bus people to the elections.
That's right.
Like, yeah.
So anyway, I won, and I won huge. I got like
crazy.
I got like 1,200 votes, was the top vote getter, so I beat that ticket. And the idea with a ticket is, well, your friends will vote for me, and my friends will vote for you, and we're going to get this big blob of votes.
Mm-hmm. Did you have a running mate?
No, I ran all on my own. So that was, you know, felt good.
What do you think was the deciding factor? What do you think put you over the top?
Well, so it's funny you should say that, because immediately the people who didn't want me on the board, who didn't want somebody who was going to ask questions and not just take the superintendent's, you know, word for things, they said, oh, he just won because of Cedar Crest. And someone wrote on an anonymous forum we have in Bukwanek that he doled out some extra mashed potatoes and got himself elected. So that's not what happened. Because if you look there's a lot of mean older people in Bukwanek.
Making the election with mashed potatoes.
You know, I thought some of the kids in town were mean growing up. Their parents are crazy. Yeah. So anyway, but that's not what happened. If you factor Cedar Crest out, I still won. And I think the reason I won is I think the people in town wanted somebody who was different, who had personal experiences with school districts, who didn't have their own agenda. I didn't have my own kids to look out for. I was looking out for all the kids, and somebody who wasn't just interested in test scores, somebody who was interested in making education better for kids. So I won, and it felt good.
So when you get into the, when you're like, okay, now I'm in it. Now right. I'm starting this thing. What going into it was your biggest hope to accomplish? I mean, you talked about it a little bit before. And then what did you kind of realize that maybe didn't sit with you well about maybe some of the difficulties of having some type of progression with?
Well, that's a great question. The problem with getting on the board when you run by yourself.
Yeah.
And I ran by myself to kind of show that I was strong on my own.
Oh, you don't have any allies?
You don't have any allies. That's right. So I was the lone wolf, and I was treated incredibly badly for my first year with the people who were on the board. I was bullied very bad. I was marginalized just because I asked questions. And I didn't think the superintendent was a god. I thought he was an employee who worked for me, who if he wanted to create a new program or new policy, he'd have to explain to me why it makes sense. You know, you go and you vote twice a month for things, and typically the board members vote yes for everything. You know, there's no questions, no discussion. You know, yes, we support the superintendent, whatever he wants goes. I didn't believe that. I thought, yes, I support the superintendent, but if I have questions, I want answers. You know, and I was also, one of the reasons I was elected was I promised to watch the money and be careful that we were spending our money in a responsible way. Which caused a lot of conflict because the people on the board think, well, you get the money from the taxpayers and we should spend it. You know, we should just spend it on things that we think make sense, even if they don't make sense, like extra administrators, for example. So I had hoped to make a number of changes.
Extra administrators? What was that?
Well, there's an idea in education right now that more supervision of teachers is better. You know, more evaluations, more judging to make sure teachers are doing their job. And some of that makes sense. You know, I'm very pro-teacher. I think teachers do phenomenal work. But there's only so much supervision you need in a district that only has under 2,000 kids. You know, you got to a point when you have an assistant to the assistant to the assistant type of deal. And
it's a lot of discrepancy on who's actually doing it.
Exactly. And there's actually less kids in the district now than there were when I first was elected.
Do you think that's cyclical?
Well, that's the debate. And personally, no, I don't. I think that we've built into the flood zone. We've built up most of the developable. How do you say that?
Developmental? Developable. I think that's a word.
It's a hard word to say, isn't it? So all the land that we could develop, I think we developed in town. So there's a finite amount of people who can move into town. And the taxes are very high. So I don't think there's going to be a tremendous bubble that we're going to have all these new kids coming to Bukwanek. But that's complicated local government issues that your father and I get to play with. Who's a fantastic mayor, by the way. He just won his primary. He'll win. We're a Republican town, so whoever is the Republican nominee for town council wins like automatically.
Yeah. I don't think Democrats win or not or run.
There's one guy who runs, who's very, very nice.
He keeps trying.
He's like the Henry Clay of local politics.
What is that?
There is a politician back in the 1800s who ran for president like 6 times.
Oh, really?
And then William Jennings Bryan just kept running again. This is the history teacher in me. But anyway, so...
the Ralph Nader.
Okay, sort of.
I just was trying to make it seem like I knew something, too.
Sort of. So I wanted to shift the focus away from standardized test scores.
Louis C.K. has talked about it, that it's a standardized test, that there's these group of people that have decided there's a way that kids are supposed to think, so we're going to teach them to the test. A lot of the curriculum throughout the year is focused on teaching to these tests rather than what the normal.
Well, so again, it's a complicated debate, and mm-hmm. I have no problem if the curriculum and the tests are synced.
Right.
If we're teaching curriculum, mm-hmm. like U.S. history, and mm-hmm. that content is on the test, and that's fine. Mm-hmm. The problem with Bequanic, you know, in 2013 was that we weren't teaching to the test. We were teaching the test. There was a class on test-taking strategies that kids were taking.
Yes.
There was a class like during the day on SAT prep. Right, instead of teaching kids music and art and Shakespeare mm-hmm. and, you know, math, we were just doing testing prep, which I was and still am, you know, quite opposed to.
I could go on for hours about how the modern public education system is weaning creativity out of kids. Sure. I talked about it on my last podcast.
Absolutely. There's a Ken Robinson, is that his name?
Are you talking about the TED Talks guy?
The TED Talks guy.
He
does some great lectures. He's a very, very bright guy, and he has this wonderful English accent. So yeah. It makes you want to watch.
I think his thesis is along the lines of, you know, the modern education system is stigmatized in a way where mistakes are the worst thing you can make, and that's the way our businesses are run now, and that in order for a kid to, you know, feel comfortable with, you know, taking the steps that eventually lead him to doing something that's creative, he needs to not be afraid to fail.
Right.
And not be afraid to speak up in a way that is kind of vulnerable, that is, I think, not happening as much in schools because kids are afraid to be wrong or be judged.
Absolutely. Well, you know, the bright, happy ending of my time on the board is, even the first year was really rough, I was much more effective the second and third year because some of the people on the board started to see that I was right about a lot of things. Some new people got elected.
Like what?
Like
what we just talked
the
about.
Superintendent not being great and needing to go. That's a big one. Other things like that. They let me be the chair of the policy committee.
Which is what?
So there's committees on the board. You have a committee for personnel. You've got a committee for curriculum. You've got a committee for finance. And then you have this thing called the policy committee, which is the most important one because the Board of Education's are not supposed to micromanage the school district. They're not supposed to be a principal or a superintendent. They're supposed to set board policy.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, we have a policy on facilities use. We have a policy on, how we evaluate teachers. You know, mm-hmm. you have different policies.
That get voted in.
You vote on these policies. We have a policy on homework. We have a policy on one of the ones I was most proud of is we were one of the first districts in New Jersey to implement a policy protecting transgender students so they could use whatever bathroom they felt comfortable using.
Oh, that's a thing now in the school system?
Oh, it's a thing. It's now the law because President Obama said that you need to allow kids to mm-hmm. use whatever bathroom they identify with to get state funding. But mm-hmm. we implemented our transgender policy in Bequanic before that happened.
Mm-hmm.
So we were on the cutting edge. And I'm very, very proud of that because I was a leader in getting that done.
Mm-hmm.
So they let me be the chair of the policy committee. And we brought in a new superintendent. Mm-hmm. The old guy quit, and I got blamed for it. And I probably contributed to making him not want to work in Bequanic.
You challenged him.
I challenged him. I would vote no on things.
Which is ridiculous that's a thing that's like...
You know, I was called very, very vulgar names that I'm not going to say. But, you know, my age was... I was constantly spoken down to because I was
a kid. Get called kid? Hey, kid.
Yeah, but profanity. It was ugly. There were some... very, very difficult people on the board.
Wow.
Most of whom are gone.
Mm-hmm.
And so this new superintendent, just like you were saying about, you know, getting answers right, you know, this idea that, you know, you take a test and you either fail or pass, we implemented this new year a new homework policy because, you know, you went through Bequanic. Homework is a big thing. You could not know anything in mathematics and still pass because you did all the homework assignments.
Yeah.
So he's very big on mastery.
Or you could do no homework and just get A's on the test.
Well, it was one or the other, wasn't it?
And then get a B.
I was that kind of kid. I didn't do any homework. I had a fantastic math teacher for 3 years.
I mean, if you had like an essay you had to write or like a big project, obviously you'd do it. But like if you had to do a page in a math booklet, like, yeah, I did it.
Right. But anyway, so he's big on mastery. So his position is we should let the kids turn in an essay a dozen times until they perfect it.
Huh.
Same thing with homework. You know, if the kid struggles, like we're not going to assign 30 math problems now. We're going to assign like 8. And if the kid struggles, he can do them again until he, you know, gets it. So, you know, Bequanica is in a much better
position. What's the fundamental, like, thinking behind how that's more effective?
Well, like I said, the basic idea is you want to encourage mastery of topics rather than just training the kids to follow instructions.
Yeah, and because then that kind of turns into like learning from your mistakes. Yeah. I'm saying the other way is kind of just learning for that time for when you need it, and then it kind of maybe doesn't sink in as much.
Right. Well, I mean, that frame of logic also says that, you know, in life there are tests.
Right.
You know, you have to take the SAT. You know, you have assignments due at your job, and you either pass or you fail, and tough luck. Right. And I get that.
I'm
a realist, but I think with kids, we should be teaching. We shouldn't just be evaluating them, you know. So, like, in my class, I tell my kids, you know, okay, you got a C on this paper. You have a week. Turn it in again, and we'll keep going until you get an A, until they don't want to work anymore. You know, because, you know, every kid can be successful. Every kid learns differently. Mm-hmm. And as teachers, we need to make sure we're teaching in ways that kids can learn.
Mm-hmm.
But that's a conversation for another day.
Yeah, I mean, you have to figure out what's best for the kid kind of individually.
And I'm weird. I think right now the only board member. Well, in terms of the Board of Education, another weird thing about me, not just being young, I'm actually a teacher on the board.
Right.
In a different district, because you can't work in the district that you're a board on. But so I bring a very different perspective than the quote-unquote business people who are on my board. You know, as somebody who's in education, there's a lot I've seen in the classroom, and there's a lot I've seen as a board member, and it, you know, together it makes me very unique.
Yeah. So how did you go about throughout? So you've been on the Board of Education for how long so far?
Well, you get elected for 3-year terms, but there was a funny thing where they moved the election to November, which extended all of our terms. So I guess in total, I'm going to end up being on the board for 3 years and 8 months.
Wow.
And my term is up in January. And as I said, I'm not running for re-election, even though they all know I could win.
What was the secret to being able to balance finishing your education with
being a local politician? Yeah, no social life. I had a girlfriend for 3 years, so that was good. But you know, other than that...
You had a girlfriend?
Yeah, I was with a girl named Ashley for 2.5 years.
Oh, did I know that? I don't know. Yeah, social media?
Yeah, probably. Yeah, there's pictures. But we're not together anymore.
Mm.
Not that that matters.
Yeah.
To your viewers who want to look me up and see how pale I am and realize that you don't want to date this guy.
Oh, come on, Tom.
Yeah. Issues.
There's things, sometimes the imperfections about people is what's most admirable.
You know? I mean, the honest answer to your question is, yeah, it was a lot of hard work.
Yeah, dude, I would never be able to. And I mean, I could barely do school. I mean, I was involved, but...
No, you were tremendously involved. Yeah. You and Mustafa were leaders at your school, right? You were in...
Yeah,
weren't you elected?
Yeah.
You know, student government and everything? I mean, that's a massive...
I was president of my class all 4 years. And I ran unopposed sophomore, junior, senior year.
Because you were so good your freshman year. How many kids went to your school? Quinnipiac, right?
Yeah, 6,000 undergrad.
Right. So that's huge.
1,600 in my class.
Right.
1,700.
Right. So it's huge.
It was fun.
You know.
Stav was senior class he was a student body president.
Senior year. Well, you worked together as a team.
Yeah.
You know, which is not surprising, having grown up with Mustafa.
Yeah.
You know, I was very happy when he got that.
Oh, he just, I've never seen someone sprout in such a positive way in college.
Yeah, we caught up, I think, our sophomore year. He went to talk to kids at Bequanic about college Dr. Durando's class, and I had been there too. And he seemed like he was doing very, very well.
Yeah. Now he's got a job at Johnson & Johnson in Baltimore. Right.
Yeah, it's weird now that everyone's grown up.
Johns Hopkins is down there. Yeah, man. Yeah. Most of my friends, except for Brian O'Hara, who lives down the street, are all gone.
Right.
It's like a weird...
It's weird.
End of an era, kind of.
Well, you talk about that millennial life, and this is sort of part of it. You know, people grow up and move apart. And like I said, we're weird that we're still here in this little town.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah.
So how did you get to, what are you like the, like an assistant in this class that you teach? Or are you like lead? Cause I remember there was student teachers who at sometimes took over the reins of the whole,
you know, thing. I'm the teacher.
That's
my cooperating teacher is a fantastic socialist teacher, probably one of the best I've ever worked with.
Mm-hmm.
And he's also got his supervision certification, so he's going to be a principal soon.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, no, I was just writing lesson plans today. We're doing Uncle Tom's Cabin and 12 Years a Slave and Gone with the Wind.
You're showing that now.
Yeah, well, I'm showing clips of it because, of course, 12 Years a Slave is incredibly brutal.
Yeah.
But I'm not one of the type of social studies teachers that sugarcoats history.
Mm.
You know, we have a fantastic, unique, remarkable country, but we have some issues in our past, and I think kids need to look at those with clear eyes, especially in a diverse area like Booton. You know, I have black kids in my class, I have white kids, I have Hispanic kids, mm-hmm. I have Asian kids, I have Muslim kids, mm-hmm. I have Indian kids. So mm-hmm. I try to make diversity something that we talk about regularly.
Yeah. Yeah, especially in the way the world is having a shit fit with all that now.
Well, it's a great time to be a history teacher with the election coming up.
Oh,
we have a lot of fun. The debate is tomorrow night,
what
so
is
my
the,
kids
what
are
is
watching
the thought
it.
Process of what how old are your kids?
They're in eighth grade, so they're 12, 13, and 14.
What do kids that young say about like Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton?
You know, it's funny you ask that because I have never seen kids more interested in an election.
Well, yeah.
They are so into it, and maybe because of the celebrity of the two candidates, but they think it's just a lot of fun, which is cool for me to teach because for once in my life, other people are interested in politics like I am.
Yeah. Are you still a libertarian?
No, I've never been a libertarian.
I remember you saying you in high school you were a libertarian. Or was Perez called said
yeah,
you were a libertarian?
We had Dave Petriello, who I think is still at the high school, used to joke with me that I should become a libertarian. Because,
why?
Because, you know, I was sort of a moderate, you know.
Yeah.
There were Republican principles I felt that were right, and there were Democratic principles I felt were right.
Yeah.
But, you know, now as an adult, I'm a Republican.
Yeah.
But I'm a New York Republican. And what I mean by that is I'm socially liberal
mm-hmm.
and economically conservative.
Mm-hmm.
So, for what it's worth.
I mean, that's interesting. I wonder what a 13-year-old would think of Donald Trump or a 14-year-old would think of Donald Trump.
They think he's racist because
yeah.
to an extent he probably is. And the media portrays him particularly as that.
Yeah.
They think Hillary Clinton is not trustworthy mm-hmm. and is not transparent, which it probably is true. You know, they're very astute into
yeah.
what's going on. And I'm really, really interested to see what their reaction to the debate is tomorrow night, because they're mm-hmm. going to be watching it as a homework assignment and doing some writing on it, you know, looking for body language and, you know, basic stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But they're very perceptive, so I'm really curious to see what they get out of it.
Yeah. Do they ever ask you your opinion?
All the time.
Do you?
Never.
Yeah.
I never tell them what
they
I
don't,
think.
They don't.
I think it's a disservice when history teachers, you know, share a bias. And even though I'm probably not biased because I'm pretty moderate and
mm-hmm.
there are things I agree with from both platforms,
mm-hmm.
I still think it's my job to present all the information in an unbiased way.
Mm-hmm. Well, Tom, we're at like 53 minutes. We usually go for that long.
And my phone is buzzing. I wonder who in the world this could be. No one calls me. Oh, it's my mom.
Oh.
It makes sense, right?
Yeah. Do you have to?
Oh, no.
Okay.
I live up the street. I sort of wave out the window and say, Mom, I'll be home soon.
I'm back. Well, I guess I want to end with, I thank you for coming and doing
this. No, thank you for having
me. For talking so candidly.
Of course.
For, you know, not shying away from things that may not
fun.
Have been easy to talk about. And, you know, how was the Giants game? It was good.
They lost, but it was a really, really close game.
Yeah. I saw some, was Odell Beckham crying?
I was writing my lesson plans, and it was on in the background, so every now and then I would look up, and the score
was
fluctuating. I don't know. You'd have to ask somebody who's in.
I saw something, you know, he was on the sideline.
I was actually watching it.
Kicked the a net, and then it, like, flew back and hit him in the face, like he was having some type of temper tantrum.
Yeah, the Giants had two easy games, you know, now I think they're 2-1.
Yeah. Are you a big Giants fan? Are you a football fan?
Not really. I watch it. I'm a tennis fan,
oh.
and I was into soccer when I was a kid, watching, not playing.
Yes,
God, that would not be pretty. But my students are really interested, you know, in sports.
So no fantasy football for
you?
Oh,
God, no.
It's too tedious for me.
Yeah, well.
You can't read Game of Thrones. I can't do it because you can't read Game of Thrones and do fantasy football at the same time. It's two tedious things on top of each other. It's too much tediousness.
Jill mentions Game of Thrones because I'm wearing my House Stark t-shirt.
Yeah.
You know, I wore graphic tees all through high school. That hasn't changed.
Yeah. Well, Tom, so we usually end with hopes for the future.
Hopes for the future.
What are we looking at for the next? What do you have? Are you a person who makes plans, or are you a person who lives in the moment?
I'm a Capricorn, so I'm kind of a planner.
Do you believe in that stuff?
I fit the description.
The moon doesn't make you a certain.
But I fit the description of what that character type is like. Mm. But I'm sort of focused on the next 3 months.
Mm-hmm. Which are going to be what?
Student teaching.
Right.
You know, making sure that I have a really good experience. Mm-hmm.
Are you doing it just for the first two market periods?
Just until December 23rd, and then I'm done. Mm-hmm. And then the following May, I'll graduate my master's and get my actual teaching certification.
Wow, master's, man.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Yeah, I got into the Rutgers fifth year program.
What does the second semester look like?
Like 16 credits of master classes. Yeah, it's going to be rough because some friends who are a little older who've gone through the program say it's really, really fun being a student teacher and getting to play teacher.
Yeah.
And then a lot of fun going back into student mode.
Mm.
So I'm not looking forward to that.
The roles are reversed.
But it'll be good. I went to Rutgers thinking I was going to be a lawyer, and there's no undergraduate program in education. Mm-hmm. So had I not gotten into this master's program, I don't know exactly what I would have done.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very, very fortunate to have been accepted. Mm-hmm. And it's a great program.
Yeah. Well, hold on. One other question I want to ask you, because this is something that's been on my mind and since you're here, and I think I would like to hear your perspective on this, the show is called That Millennial Life, and I don't really, it's called That Millennial Life because each person that I talk to is a millennial and it highlights their life,
right.
But I don't really ask or haven't asked many questions about what this guest thinks about our generation in a broad way. So I was wondering if you what do you see in our generation now, like recent college grads, people in their 20s, in the way that the world is now? This is a very loaded question.
No, it's a good question.
I'm
probably not qualified to answer it.
Yeah, well, I mean.
Because I'm not a typical.
Yeah. Well, I'm saying that's what I'm saying. You're not typical, so like.
But I'll take a stab at it. On the positive side, I think you have a lot of people our age who are very passionate about making changes
in
society, whether it's environmental stuff or, political stuff, or in my case, education. There's a lot of millennials who are not willing to just accept the status quo.
Mm.
And I think that's our one really great feature about our people our age. You know, and you have some quirks.
That could come with maybe people being a little too adamant.
There's certainly an intensity.
Yeah.
but I think that's a positive thing. I mean, I think on the downside, I think we're definitely too into social media.
Mm-hmm.
I've been doing that thing on Instagram where there's that Insta-snap thing now.
Yeah.
Where I put my Snapchat trying to get people to add me and no one ever does.
Yeah.
And the joke's on you people because I see all you looking at my Instagram thing and no one ever has me on Snapchat.
I think I look today. I'll add you on Snapchat.
Yeah, no one will add me.
I'll add you. We'll
Snapchat Tom_Salerno. Just a plug there. But anyway, I think as a generation, we're too obsessed with social media.
Right.
We're too interested in what people think about us in terms of our appearance and our public image.
Right.
But again, I think it's a great generation. I'm very proud to have been the first millennial to be in local government in our small town.
Well, yeah.
Hopefully I'll inspire some kids to want to be involved in politics in some way or some social change.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Well, Tom, it's nice catching up with you.
Yeah, it was great. We haven't talked in such a long
time.
Let's
try to
nice.
Keep in touch. And
yeah, definitely. And I mean, I do live 10 houses up.
Yeah. All right, cool. Thanks, buddy. All right, that is it. Thank you, Tom. Thank you for sharing everything that you did and speaking so candidly and not shying away, like I said, from topics of conversation that most people wouldn't be as comfortable talking about. Thank you for doing everything you've done for our town and for fighting for students and making sure that they get the best education possible. It's very admirable. So yeah, thank you to everyone who's listened. You can like our Facebook page, That Millennial Life. You can follow the Twitter, That Mill Life. I still gotta use that more. I haven't been as much. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You know, you could do that. You can leave a rating and a review on iTunes. It helps the show a lot. And other than that, that's pretty much it. I hope everyone has a good week. I'll have another episode for you next Monday. So long.